Gallup polling suggests that as of last year, 53% of Americans supported capital punishment for murder. But that support is on a downward trend, and concerns are growing over the number of people on death row who have been exonerated. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. There are new calls to abolish the death penalty in light of wrongful convictions. Today, we examine the question of wrongful conviction and the death penalty with those advocating for reform and with a prosecuting attorney who argues the death penalty must remain an option. Joining me first are Lamont Hunter, who was wrongfully convicted and spent nearly 18 years incarcerated with most of that time on death row before gaining his freedom. Thank you for being here, Lamont.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
His attorney, Aaron Gallagher Barnhart, assistant federal public defender in the Southern District of Ohio's Capital Habeas Unit. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
And Pierce Reed, Director of Policy and Engagement with the Ohio Innocence Project at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. Thanks for being here, Pierce.
Thanks for the invitation.
UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Lamont, I want to start with your story. Could you please tell us what happened back in 2006 with Little Trustin?
Yes. So it was January 2006. They started off normal. Trustin had an accident, fell down the stairs, a flight of stairs to the basement. We rush him to the hospital. We get him to the hospital, and I tell him what happened. They don't believe what happened, and the law enforcement and prosecutor's office went forward with their charges, and they charged me with capital murder, aggravated murder, rape, and child endangering. Mm.
And Lamont, what went through your mind when you realized you were being accused of all those things?
Oh my God, a plethora of things. I can't pinpoint one, but I know one. I was afraid, scared, shocked. A lot of things. I've never been through a trial before in my life. I've had contact with the law enforcement and the criminal legal system, but nothing like that.
Hmm. Aaron, talk about how Lamont's case went through the court system and how you ended up getting involved.
Sure. So as Lamont mentioned, he had a trial in state court in Hamilton County, and he was convicted on the theory of what's sometimes called shaken baby syndrome, or abusive head trauma. And so, as he mentioned, Trustin had fallen down this entire flight of stairs and eventually succumbed to his injuries. And he presented with three injuries that are commonly seen in these shaken baby cases as indicative of abuse. And a lot has developed over the past decades that has let the science know that actually, these injuries can be caused in a variety of situations. But unfortunately, even back in 2007, when Lamont was tried, his lawyer didn't bother to find the experts that could have rebutted what the child abuse pediatrician was saying at trial. So he was put on trial, and the expert testimony was there's no way Trustin could have sustained these injuries from falling down a set of stairs. And so Lamont must have abused him and beaten him to death. And he also had some injuries in his rectum, which the coroner said looked like three puncture wounds, like maybe he'd been stabbed by a pencil. And so that was the basis of the rape charge as well. And, you know, Lamont said, like, I can tell you what happened to, you know, his head. He fell down the stairs, but he had no answer for these rectal injuries. And so that's why he was convicted of rape as well. And so his case wound its way through the state court appellate system. And after that finished is when I got involved in the case separately in federal courts, doing what's called habeas corpus litigation.
And habeas corpus litigation, we won't ask you for a huge legal definition of that because I'm sure it gets complicated. But in your work, you uncovered this other evidence or other possible explanations for what happened to Trustin, who, if I'm remembering correctly, was only three at the time. So a little bitty kid. talk about what these other explanations were. You talked about falling down the steps and the head injury, but talk about some of these other injuries and what other explanations came to light.
That's right. So the first thing we did was go to the experts and show them, you know, the evidence. We went to the site. We took measurements and photographs of the staircase. We had a pediatric forensic pathologist and a biomechanical engineer. And so they said, absolutely, falling down these stairs, someone the age and height of Trustin could account for these, you know, head injuries that he suffered in his brain and his eyes. But then it was our investigator, Pam Swanson, carefully combing through the medical records, which apparently nobody had done before this point. And she discovered some notations in the emergency room that said that that personnel had attempted to take Trustin's rectal temperature 3 times unsuccessfully. And it was not until those attempts that any blood was noted on Trustin's rectum. Hmm. And so we were able to, in federal court, obtain a discovery process from our judge. And eventually that meant we deposed the coroner who had conducted Trustin's autopsy and testified at trial. And so when we showed her pictures of the scene, explained some of the reports that Lamont had said, you know, he was down the basement at the time and he heard Trustin running above the floor, you know, the ceiling, the first floor above him. And she, to her credit, admitted she hadn't considered that he might be running. Mm-hmm. And she hadn't seen pictures of the scene. And there's this particular sort of ledge or wall along the side of the stairs that she said, wow, you know, that corresponds with a long linear bruise that I saw on Trustin's back. And, you know, considering all these things, she had been honest at trial that a fall down the stairs might account for, you know, some of the head injuries, but it still couldn't explain these rectal injuries. But then when we showed her the records about the rectal thermometer, she immediately changed her opinion on both. So she said, my opinion is no longer homicide, that it's undetermined, the cause of death, and that the cause of these punctures in his rectum was due to medical intervention.
Pierce, there are so many details in this case, and I know every case is different, but how do the factors in this case compare to other cases the Innocence Project has been involved with? Are there similarities that you can see?
Yes, one of them is exactly what Aaron's just described, which at the time that Trustin was injured and died, everyone believed something to be true. The idea of shaken baby syndrome and the medical science that supported it at the time, or arguably did. But what we gain with additional education and research is better understanding of things like shaken baby syndrome. It's sometimes called junk science, but I think a better word for it is shifting science. And science grows on itself, and we know that. But so often, whether it's shaken baby syndrome or gunshot residue analysis or hair or bite mark analysis, we gain that knowledge. And that's exactly what we should do. But it's hard from a legal perspective to go back and revisit that science after the fact, because law does not like change. It wants to cling to precedent and to finality. So that's one of the issues that every Innocence Project, including OIP, faces when they're looking at these cases. We also recognize there was a real tragedy here. This precious little child died, and that child deserves justice. Every victim does. So we tread lightly in these cases, and we want to make sure that we're right before we ever go into court. And the flip side of it is when you meet a man like Lamont, you're reminded of what we lose when we wrongfully convict someone. He's somebody I'd love to have as a brother, a neighbor, a friend. He's an amazing human being. And the idea of someone like him being in prison for something he didn't do, particularly a case with these kinds of facts and outcomes, is something that should be very sobering for all of us. So unfortunately, Lamont is one example of what we see with a lot of innocent people who are wrongfully convicted, both here in Ohio and around the country.
There's a Texas case that's been in the news this month, the case of Robert Roberson. He was sentenced to die in connection with the death of his 2-year-old daughter in 2002. Since then, evidence has come to light that
throw his conviction and even his daughter's cause of death into doubt. It's another shaken baby syndrome case. A bipartisan group of state lawmakers want the governor of Texas to spare his life. Pierce, what do you make of this case? Is this one that you've been following? How does this stand out for you in terms of the cases like this across the country?
What stands out about that case is the legislative response. That's highly unusual. But so many other aspects of the case are similar to ones that we see here, both the shaken baby syndrome, but also the understanding that that man's neuroatypical, has autism or is on the spectrum. I don't know that people are fully aware of how that translates when a law enforcement agent is assessing somebody they suspect of such a horrible crime. So we see that not typically with people with autism, but that's one example of it. We have almost cultural understandings of how somebody should be acting. But we do see that with other things around the country. There's a pretty infamous case in Massachusetts, an Asian woman who was deemed a suspect because she wasn't manifesting a particular way of grief over the death of her parents. Part of it was that she was in shock, but also the cultural aspect of it was she wasn't supposed to show emotion. And that's one example, just like the Texas case, of how our perceptions of what somebody should appear as, if those perceptions aren't met, we can be punitive. We can treat them in a way that we shouldn't. We should take our time and do complete and thorough investigations to make sure that we really do understand why somebody may be manifesting the behaviors they are showing or what they're not showing.
Lamont, Aaron explained this new evidence that came to light in your case and what it meant in federal court in terms of what the coroner said. You ended up accepting a plea deal in your case and leaving prison that same day. Explain why you decided to accept that plea. I know from the very beginning you maintained your innocence in the face of this, you know, murder charge and certainly this sexual assault charge. Talk to us about why you decided the plea was the way to go.
There was a number of factors that led me to take the plea. Frustration, being forced, faced with spending another year and a half, maybe 2 years in prison, facing another death penalty trial because the prosecutor's office was fully aware, fully prepared to try me again. In conversations with my family, you know, in particular, my oldest son, my junior, Lamont Jr. A conversation with my family and Lamont, you know, he said, "Daddy, you know, it's never been about because the prosecutors offered me a plea agreement. In my opinion, to spare them embarrassment in the media and all of that, you know, with wrongfully convicted." So the judge granted us a new trial, and I wanted the judge to weigh in about the bond situation because I felt like I was being my freedom was being leveraged against me by holding me in prison. So I would have liked to have made that decision, at least being out of jail, you know, out on bond. But, you know, the judge set the bond so high I couldn't make bond. So, you know, it led me to, you know, to make a hard decision, you know, because if had I went to another trial and got convicted of anything lesser, you know, than aggravated murder, rape and child endangerment, I still wouldn't have been able, eligible for compensation. A brief conversation with my son, he told me, you know, Daddy, it's never been about the money. You know, it's never been about the money. It's always been about the truth and you coming home. And so, you know, after having those conversations with my family, I just chose to go ahead and accept a plea to a lesser offense and gain my freedom back.
Yeah. Yeah. You missed a lot of years with those kids.
Absolutely. They took a lot from me and me and my family. You know, trauma is real. We all still suffer from it, but we're trying to manage as best as possible.
Yeah. Pierce, I want to ask you a final question. UC Law is hosting a program November 1st examining the death penalty and wrongful convictions. Just briefly, what's the message you want to convey during that program? What's the message you're really trying to get out?
Part of it is to remind people that Ohio remains a death penalty state. That's why we're here, because there haven't been as many executions over the last 6 or 8 years. People sometimes forget that it's a perfectly lawful outcome here in Ohio, and that we have over 100 people on death row. National estimates are that about 4% of people on death row are innocent, and somewhere between 8 and 11 people, by all accounts, have been exonerated from our death row. So it's to remind people that this is real, and it's literally a matter of life and death, both in Ohio and around the country, but also that there are legislative responses that could change that. Two bills now pending in the Ohio General Assembly, both of which would abolish the death penalty, as well as a researcher who's going to be present to talk about how this influences policymakers' decision-making about all things in the criminal legal system, including the death penalty.
Well, I've been talking with Lamont Hunter, who was wrongfully convicted, his attorney, Aaron Gallagher Barnhart, assistant federal public defender in the Southern District of Ohio's Capital Habeas Unit, and Pierce Reed, director of policy and engagement with the Ohio Innocence Project at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We continue our discussion on the death penalty and questions of wrongful conviction. Now we talk with a prosecuting attorney who says the country needs to have death as the ultimate punishment for the most heinous crimes. Joining me is Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association Executive Director Lewis Tobin. Welcome back, Lou.
Thanks, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
We appreciate your being here. Talk with us about why you believe Ohio needs to have the death penalty as the ultimate punishment.
Well, look, there are just certain types of crimes that warrant a punishment that's more severe than getting to live out the rest of your life in prison. And so I'm thinking specifically of things like multiple murders or mass murders, where someone is facing life without parole for committing the first murder. And they've murdered a second person or a third or more. And there needs to be some additional amount of justice for those multiple victims. I'm thinking of cases where there are murders of children. The most recent death penalty imposed in Franklin County, where I am, was imposed for the murder of a four-year-old child. And the offender murdered his girlfriend in a dispute over child support, turned around and saw that their four-year-old daughter had witnessed the murder, and so he brutally murdered her too. He was going to spend the rest of his life in prison for murdering his girlfriend, and so there has to be some justice for the four-year-old child. I'm thinking of acts of terrorism where the public is due some ultimate amount of justice for possibly dozens or hundreds of murders, or the murder of police. The second reason that I would say prosecutors support the death penalty is just public support for the death penalty. Polling for the death penalty is consistently over 50%, even when somebody asks a generic question like, do you support the death penalty for murder? But not all murders are death penalty eligible. And so when you ask people about the specific types of murder, like the ones that I just mentioned, and whether they support the death penalty for those, support for the death penalty goes up to 70 or even close to 80%. So the public and their desire for justice and these heinous crimes is really what drives our support.
What do prosecutors hear from victims? What kind of justice do victims or survivors, family members who are survivors of people who've been killed, what do they say they want?
Yeah, victims aren't a monolith. So victims want different things, and prosecutors have a responsibility to listen to victims and to try to proceed in ways that meet the outcomes that victims want. And so there are cases where the victims will say, look, I don't want to go through the appellate process for this for years and years. And the prosecutor's got a responsibility to listen to that. But there are other cases where, you know, if and I'm thinking of a case where there is multiple victims and you have two sets of victims' families. One wants the death penalty. The other set of victims don't. And the prosecutors got to make a decision about ultimately what's best for the public and what justice demands. That's what they're elected to do. They get charged with these consequential decisions, and ultimately they've got, while they owe the duty to the victims to hear them out, they've got to do what's best for the state and what's best for the public.
Critics of the death penalty talk about the thousands of people who've been exonerated in the U.S. after wrongful convictions, including about 200 people on death row who've been exonerated. That dates back since the 70s. They argue once somebody is executed, there's no reversing that. What do you make of those numbers and that argument?
Well, look, it's critical that the death penalty provide due process, that it be applied fairly, and that it be accurate. And what I would say is that prosecutors today aren't pursuing the death penalty in cases where there's any residual doubt about the person's guilt. And even our former public defender, in testimony on one of these death penalty repeal bills a couple of years ago, acknowledged that during his testimony. He said, look, today's death penalty cases don't turn on whether the person did it or didn't do it. We know that they did it. Whether they're going to get the death sentence or not turns on the mitigating circumstances versus the aggravating factors. And so, you know, it's just bad public policy to throw out a bunch of properly imposed sentences and to throw out an entire criminal justice policy based on these arguments about a handful of old cases where there are some questions, maybe questions about the evidence. You know, that we have safeguards in place for those cases. We have an appellate process. We have a post-conviction process. And ultimately, you know, who are these people? Is the residual doubt about their case legitimate? And if so, the governor's got the power to commute the sentence. It's just not an argument to do away with the death penalty altogether when we're assured of the person's guilt.
Do you think there's any need for reform when we have these cited cases where there are questions about the evidence and it can take years and years to work through that?
You know, I think the cases where people have been exonerated are evidence that our system works the way that it should. Yes, it does take a long time. But in most cases, there are legitimate disputes about the evidence and what the evidence shows. Only one person in Ohio can actually claim to have been taken off of death row due to actual innocence. Other people are taken off of death row in old cases because there are procedural questions about the evidence. A witness has changed their mind. There are questions about the effectiveness of defense counsel. And those aren't the same things as a person being actually innocent. And, you know, even in Mr. Hunter's case, he ultimately pled guilty to a lesser offense. I think the system that we have in place works. I think the safeguards that we have in place work. Certainly, we want death sentences to be accurate. And I think we've made improvements over the years to ensure that that happens.
So how do you think prosecutors are working to ensure that death penalty cases, prosecutions are applied fairly and accurately?
Well, I can tell you that over the years, we've worked on a variety of legislation with the General Assembly and with the Supreme Court. So we now have open discovery in Ohio, which we didn't have prior to 2011. We have better DNA collection and DNA testing than we had in the 1990s and early 2000s. We have better post-conviction relief procedures in place than we used to have. And we have better criminal indigent defense and capital cases than we used to have. Those are all policies that I think have helped ensure that the death penalty is accurate. I think prosecutors are more circumspect about the types of cases where they should seek the death penalty now. If you look at the cases where it has been sought over the last several years, they're almost all multiple murders. The one that stands out that wasn't was the kidnapping, rape, and brutal murder of a 13-year-old girl in Cuyahoga County. So I think prosecutors are a lot more sensitive than they used to be to what the evidence shows and the types of cases where the death penalty is what justice demands.
Have you been following this case we talked about earlier, this case of Robert Roberson in Texas? I wonder what you make of that case, if you've been following it, and what that says about, you know, cases of people who are currently on death row, maintain their innocence, have been going through appeals processes for years, and, you know, maybe science has changed, evidence has changed. What do you make of all that?
I haven't followed it that closely. I'm only familiar with it on the surface level. But what I will tell you is, again, I think in these cases where there's shifting science or a witness has changed their opinion from what their opinion was at trial, the evidence might be in dispute. You know, the prosecution and the state don't have to roll over just because a defendant and their defense counsel claim to have evidence that shows something different. What I'll also say is that I know prosecutors in Ohio who have gotten people out of prison when DNA evidence, for example, has showed that someone else committed the crime. And so I think, you know, prosecutors here do a good job of defending the cases that they should, where the evidence is in dispute, but also recognizing when there were past mistakes and trying to rectify those.
So do you believe that we can have a system where we can be confident, the public can be confident beyond a reasonable doubt that someone who is sentenced to death is guilty of the crimes they're sentenced for?
I truly believe that the cases that we have now, the public can be assured of the person's guilt. And I think for probably all the cases that are left of people on death row, the public can be assured of the person's guilt. And if there are legitimate questions about what the evidence shows and residual doubt in any of these older cases, there are safeguards in place that can help rectify those wrongs.
Well, I've been talking with Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association Executive Director Lewis Tobin. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Up next, is hearing loss on the rise among younger people? This is Cincinnati Edition.